From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Norman Mailer has a big talent and a big ego. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with him about both. Also today, Lyrics and Fiction by Joe Keenan. He has a musical in the works. His new novel is a farce about a lyricist who's writing a club act for a bad but exceptionally wealthy singer. Film critic Stephen Schiff reviews David Cronenberg's adaptation of William Burroughs' Naked Lunch. And rock historian Ed Ward takes us back four decades to 1952. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A new ceasefire in Croatia has gone into effect. It was agreed to yesterday by the military leaders of the Serbian-dominated Federal Army and Croatian forces. The success or failure of the ceasefire will determine whether UN peacekeeping troops will be sent to Croatia. But as Kathy Jenkins reports from Zagreb, fighting continued right up until the deadline.
Anti-aircraft fire broke out over Zagreb minutes before the ceasefire was meant to come into effect. The city was already blacked out and under a general alert. Throughout the previous hour, the thud of distant explosions could be heard, apparently to the south of the capital. Air attacks were reported earlier on the Adriatic port of Zadar and rocket attacks on towns in other regions. At least 15 towns remain under general alert. Today's fighting was perhaps predictable. Violence has tended to intensify in the run-up to all of Croatia's previous ceasefires. In the frontline village of Mošentica, 50 kilometers south of Zagreb, Croatian fighters were today being cautious about the prospects for an end to fighting. One local commander said Croatia's ceasefires were a bit like having children. The first always brought joy. By the time you got to the 15th, you didn't know how to respond. For National Public Radio, this is Kathy Jenkins in Zagreb.
Election officials in Algiers said today that some results of last week's parliamentary elections may be thrown out. The official said that dozens of challenges have been filed in races that were apparently won by Islamic fundamentalists. The Islamic Salvation Front appeared to be a landslide winner last week with 188 seats, 28 short of a majority. Election officials said 341 appeals were filed, mostly against the Islamic Party. Two leading Democratic senators unveiled a plan today aimed at reviving the economy. The plan relies on a short-term infusion of spending that would increase the federal deficit by $55 billion and would violate the 1990 budget agreement. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Senate Budget Committee Chairman James Sasser and Joint Economic Committee Chairman Paul Sarbanes opened the second session of the 102nd Congress today by calling for middle-class tax cuts and grants and loans to state and local governments for public works projects. Senator Sarbanes said the 1990 budget agreement did not envision that the economy would go to pieces.
I mean, we think these circumstances are serious. We think they constitute a very significant change from the economic circumstances that existed at the time of the budget agreement.
Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell called the plan constructive but stopped short of endorsing it. In a series of hearings beginning next week, the details of the plan are to be worked out. Witnesses scheduled to testify include leading economists, union and business leaders, Boston Mayor Ray Flynn, and New York Governor Mario Cuomo. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
The Dow Industrials gained 29 points to close at a record 3,201. This is NPR. Israeli Defense Minister Moshe Aaron says that no pressure will bring about a change in Israel's decision to expel 12 residents of the Israeli-occupied territories. The PLO is asking the United Nations Security Council to meet on Israel's decision to expel the 12, a move that prompted the Palestinian delegation to suspend plans to fly to Washington for the resumption next week of Middle East peace talks. Patricia Golan reports from Jerusalem.
Defense Minister Ahrens defended the decision to deport the 12 made after a Jewish settler was shot to death in the Gaza Strip. Military authorities claim the 12 are responsible for incitement to terrorism. All the Palestinians on the deportation list are in Israeli prisons. They have the right of appeal to a military tribunal and the Israeli Supreme Court, both of which have always turned down such appeals in the past. Aaron said that if the Palestinian delegation refuses to go to the Washington peace talks, it shows it has no reservations about terrorist activity. Palestinian delegation spokeswoman Hanana Shrawi said the Israeli decision was designed to sabotage the peace process, and she called on the Americans to intervene. The Palestinian delegates are under great pressure from groups opposed to the peace process. Most of those slated for deportation belong to opposition groups. For National Public Radio, this is Patricia Golan in Jerusalem.
The investigation of the Maxwell publishing empire widened today as British auditors announced that $1.4 billion were taken from the Maxwell Communication Corporation. The firm was the late Robert Maxwell's major public company. Court-appointed accountants have found that the money was taken from the company in the months before Maxwell's mysterious death at sea off the Canary Islands. Britain's Serious Fraud Office is conducting four other investigations of Maxwell's companies, including the disappearance of assets and pension money from Mirror Group newspapers. The accountant's report showed that Maxwell had gambled in the foreign exchange market using money from his various businesses. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Norman Mailer once wrote that before he was 17, he had formed the desire to be a major writer. Well, that wish certainly came true. He was famous at the age of 25 after the publication of his war novel, The Naked and the Dead. He's since won two Pulitzers and a National Book Award. And as novelist Scott Spencer recently wrote about Mailer, for a writer to inspire the controversy and divisions that routinely orbit Mailer's life and career is perhaps unprecedented in American literary history. Some of the controversies to which Spencer refers have been about Mailer's macho code, his feuds with feminists, his venture into politics running for New York City mayor, and his championing of writer and convicted killer Jack Henry Abbott. But the main controversy about his latest book, Harlot's Ghost, was over whether it was too long and if it was any good. Harlot's Ghost is an over 1,300-page epic about the CIA. I spoke to Mailer when it was published in the fall. Norman Mailer was one of the first great American writers to also be a media personality and to have that personality be a part of his art. I asked Mailer if he thinks of his public self as being one of his greatest characters.
No, I'm amused by it because people have such an outlandish idea of me, and I'm always intrigued with it. They really are so surprised when they meet me. If I've heard one remark 1,000 times in my life, it's that, oh, you know, you're not the least bit the way I thought you'd be. I'm a measure of how bad and inaccurate the newspapers are. The sad truth is that most people who write for newspapers are mediocre writers. So the mark of mediocrity is to look for precedent. So they'll open the files on me, and whatever's been written about me before gets written again, thereby confirming the error.
But you did at some point, I think, almost make a decision to cultivate a public personality on TV, you know, on the Cavett Show, on Merv, on David Susskind's show, saying really provocative things. I mean, you even write in advertisements. I think it was in advertisements for myself about how you'd kind of like studied TV to think about how you could best come across on it and to most kind of accurately get across the thought or the emotion that you wanted to.
Yeah, but I've given up on that. I don't think you can communicate through TV. Some people may be able to, but I can't. My ideas are too...
complicated?
Yes, too complicated, too full of... too full of nuance. When you start trying to communicate through TV or, for that matter, through newspaper stories... your remarks get garbled and bizarre. I mean, whenever I read a story about myself, I generally shudder a bit. I say, oh, what a bizarre, ugly, sort of off-balance person I appear to be in that story.
You used to always measure yourself against other writers. In advertisements for myself, you wrote, "It is my present and future work which will have the deepest influence of any work being done by an American novelist in these years. I could be wrong, and if I am, then I am the fool who will pay the bill." Do you think your assessment of your own work has changed over the years?
I think I'm a little more relaxed about it. Either my work will or it won't have all that huge effect. Sometimes I hope it will. Sometimes I think it absolutely won't. My real fear these days is not who's going to be the best writer of us all, but whether novel writing as such is going to continue with any health into the 20th century. I'm not sure it's going to. I think 50 years from now, a novelist may be looked upon as the way most people regard poets, which is, they do a very special kind of work. It doesn't have much relevance to my own life. I read a poem once in a while, people say. So I think in 50 years I can say, you know, I think I'm going to read another novel this year. You know, it'll be a most special and peculiar activity almost, because I think television is driving everything else out.
But how do you size yourself up now when you compare yourself to the other major writers of your generation?
Oh, I think, I'm not going to name them. I think about three or four of us who may last, and I would say I'm one of them.
If you're just joining us, Norman Mailer is my guest, and his new novel is called Harlot's Ghost. Your image has always been of the two-fisted intellectual, and you've said that you were a physical coward as a child. When did being manly and being able to fight become important to you?
In my second marriage, my then-wife's father had been a professional fighter, and whenever he came over to visit us, he used to say, come on, let's put on the gloves. He was about 20 years older than me, but of course he knew more about boxing than I did. So I learned quickly and the hard way. And then after that, I got interested in it and did more and more boxing. And then I became friends with a couple of professional fighters. And finally, I've had a great friendship with Jose Torres over the years and have boxed with him a great deal. He was, at one time, he was the light heavyweight champion of the world. Now, of course, boxing with someone who's as good as that is relatively safe because, you know, he can handle you with no pain, and therefore he has no particular interest in hurting you. So, but I did learn an awful lot about defense while boxing with him, because if he tapped me once, and then if I didn't make the proper move the next time, he tapped me a little harder. So after a while, he put a great many instinctive defensive moves into me.
But getting back to that image of the two-fisted intellectual, why was that important to you, to not just be a bookish intellectual?
Well, I could answer you by saying, why not? What's so wonderful about being a bookish intellectual? If you're just bookish, there's a tendency to get terribly bitter about people who are physical. And my feeling always from the beginning was, if I want to be a novelist, I've got to be a novelist who can encompass all kinds of experience. My ambition was always, don't ever narrow down the horizons of what you want to write about. Try for as much as you possibly can try for. Learn more all the time. It's stultifying to be a novelist unless you keep opening up working with larger and larger, not necessarily larger and larger canvases, but either larger canvases or more powerful themes.
You went from Harvard into the Army. I think you fought in the Philippines during World War II.
Yes.
Was that the first time that physical strength counted more than intellectual ability in your life?
I would say so, yes. In fact, I went through... I grew up in Brooklyn, and you know, we didn't ignore strength in Brooklyn, but it wasn't. I grew up in a reasonable neighborhood, reasonable middle class neighborhood, but I do think that the what counted for more than strength or the lack of it was the fact that I went from Brooklyn to Harvard to the Army. So I went through two major transitions in 5 years, and the shock of that. And then a few years later, The Naked and the Dead was written and came out. So in a space of about 8 years, I went through three major transitions. The third being that I went from being an unknown young man to who just recently gotten out of the Army to being a young celebrity, and that was the largest transition of them all. It was extraordinary.
How did who you saw yourself as being compare when you were in Harvard and when you were in the Army?
Well, I just had a totally different view of myself. You know, young people at Harvard. Harvard was a wonderful place in those days, and you were coddled a bit. You know, we were treated as gentlemen. We were treated as young people who are going to be, without ever saying it, the assumption was that we were going to play a reasonably interesting role in life, and everybody cultivated everyone else's opinion. I remember it as an incredibly polite place and very nice, and even if you were discriminated against, you never knew it. It was all done so subtly. Whereas the Army, of course, was rough as a corn cob, and... So that was a huge transition. And then I wasn't very good in the Army. I wasn't a good soldier. And I'd gone from having a rather elevated opinion of myself to a poor opinion of myself. So my ego was on the elevator in those days.
Was it important to you as a writer to be in the Army and meet men who weren't like you, who weren't from the same background or the same region?
Oh, I think it turned me into an altogether different kind of writer. If I'd never gone to the Army, I believe I would have written novels that... probably would have been a little bit like the works of Iris Murdoch, maybe not as good, but I would have had intricate philosophical novels with characters who, to say the least, would be somewhat extreme and distorted and intense. And going into the Army, talking in quick terms, maybe much more of a naturalist.
You know, you said your ego was on the elevator, you know, between Harvard and the Army. It really started to be on the elevator when you started to write. You know, The Naked and the Dead, as you say, made you into celebrity, but your next two books weren't reviewed as favorably, didn't sell as well. What kind of mood swings did that create in you?
Well, huge mood swings, but the happy end to the story is that by now I have an ego that I'm afraid is like a battleship, just try and sink it.
Is it good or bad for a writer to have a big ego?
It has its advantages. Obviously, you can go through a mess of bad reviews. And, you know, most of my books over the years have had more bad reviews than good reviews. I'm the only major writer in America who has had more bad reviews than good reviews in the course of his writing life. So that gives me a certain a pride in it. You know, they keep taking their shot, their best shot, and they can't do a goddamn thing, and they're not going to stop me. And, you know, and you can get a little vain about it that way. But the bad part about having a tough ego is you become less percipient. Ego is a shell, essentially. And so you start to close off experience from yourself. The ideal would be to have a light, flexible ego that's there, that can concentrate in a given place to protect you when the going gets tough, but that it doesn't cut off too much. At my worst, I often feel like a turtle. I just pull my head in and let it rattle off the shell.
Right.
But, of course, I'm not seeing a damn thing except my own darkness at that point.
Huh. Norman Mailer is my guest, and he has a new novel about the CIA called Harlot's Ghost. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Norman Mailer is my guest. You know, you might be one of the few major writers of your generation who is Jewish and for whom Jewishness hasn't been a major theme in your fiction. Do you think that's true, that you're one of the few?
Yes, and I think it hasn't been a major theme, but I think on the other hand, it's informed every sentence I've written. You know, being Jewish is a state of mind. It's a way of receiving life and perceiving it and evaluating it, and it affects every one of one's judgments. It affects one's style. In fact, it was Norman Podaritz, once remarked many years ago that there were two kinds of Jews in history, he felt, if one were to speak very generally. One was the essentially Orthodox Jew who returned to tradition and was deeply enmeshed in it and thought of himself or herself as a Jew and primarily a Jew and always a Jew. And then there was the Jew who became the mirror of the time and aped the manners of all those people who were not Jewish, didn't copy them literally, but became so sensitive to the manners of those who are not Jewish that he might end up knowing more about it than they did. One example of this is, although he was not Jewish, his parents were Jewish. Disraeli is a wonderful example of that. He didn't look British, but he was more British. He was more English than the English. So in that sense, I think I would belong to that second category. I've always been interested in writing about things that are not Jewish precisely because I half understand them and I want to know more about them. But I think that, I've never said to myself, well, I'm really not Jewish. I know damn well how Jewish I am.
I think that kind of is consonant with the image of the writer as spy. You know, the writer is always looking at the people who he's not a part of.
Well, that's very good, by the way. You know, the writer is spy. I think in a way, writing about the CIA couldn't have been more natural for me because I've been a spy all my life. So I can understand spies.
The writer Blanche McCreary Boyd had an appreciation of your work recently in The Village Voice. She wrote, Mailer's work has demonstrated an aggressive sexism, and he has, as a consequence, become a cultural icon of offensiveness about women. Do you think you deserve to be a cultural icon of offensiveness about women?
Well, why don't you read the rest of her?
Oh, she loved your work. I just thought this was one way of getting to this issue. I should say here, she really loves your work and the new novel as well. Just to put this into context.
Well, I just shrug when we get into that because she started with that to show the distance that the book took her.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, as she read the book, as I understood her review, she was saying, in effect, I'm beginning to forgive him more and more because this book is so good And finally, at the end, she was saying, it hardly matters what I think his ideas and his attitudes are toward women. I just, I love this book because it just keeps me reading and so forth and so forth. Whatever. It's hard for me to talk about a good review after all. A man my age who's preening is kind of silly. But as far as the... as far as being an icon of the awful to a lot of women's liberationists, yes, it's absolutely true, but I also think it's silly. I don't think they read me. I think they proceed on a notion of me that has very little to do with what I really write about all the time. I think if they were to read what I write, they'd be startled. On the other hand, I think the worst of the women's liberationists are incapable of reading. They're interested only in political correctness. So how the hell can they read?
I wonder if you think that the best aspects of the women's movement, the most open and least doctrinaire, have affected your view of women or your view of yourself as a man.
Oh, no question. I think what women are maybe beginning to face now is as they gain equality with men, they're also going to be taking on all of men's problems. And a great many of men's problems are just dreary. And on top of that, since men have been, in effect, wrecking the world, let's speak ecologically, look what man has done to the natural world. The question is, once women become equal to men, are they going to then begin to direct the world into better places? There's very little evidence of that so far. One's idea of women's liberation at this point is women in trim, gray business suits carrying small attaché cases working as high executives. Isn't that the general perception of what women's liberation is about these days? That at the very least, even the most hidebound corporation has to have its token woman in a high office?
It's one narrow part of it. I want to read something that you wrote in the 1950s in Advertisements for Myself. You wrote, "Fitzgerald was an indifferent caretaker of his talent, and I have been a cheap gambler with mine. As I add up the accounts, I cannot like myself too much, for I was cowardly when I should have been good and too brave on many a bad chance. And I spent my first 30 years abusing my body, and the last 6 in forced marches on my brain. And so I am more stupid today than I ought to be. My memory is half gone, and my mind is slow. From fear and vanity, I paid out too much for what I managed to learn. I may have wasted too much of myself, and if I have, what a loss." Can you update that for us? Do you ever feel like Do you ever feel those kinds of emotions that you expressed when you were 36 in that passage?
No. In the act of writing that, I was able to move away from that. You know, much of writing is I wouldn't call it exorcism, but it is transformation. Very occasionally, it's transcendence. If you can absolutely capture a state of mind at a given moment, then you very often are freed of that state of mind. That was written out of the deep fear. In those years, it was written out of the deep fear that I had ruined myself.
From
these abuses, you know, pot, booze, all of that. But I think in the course of writing it, some little part of me said, well, stop complaining so much because actually this is rather a well-written passage.
At the age of 68, which you are now, do you feel that you have no time for certain shenanigans that you participated in when you were younger?
Oh, time is obsessive now. Not obsessive, that's too strong a word, but it's present in almost every thought I have, put it that way. You know, I don't know how much longer I have, 10 years, 15 years at most, and there's so many things I want to get done yet. So, no, I have no time for shenanigans. I've got to get the work out.
So how has that changed your public life, the public Norman Mailer?
Well, I'm much quieter now. You know, a lot of people complain secretly. They say, well, you know, Norman has gotten so mellow, he's boring. But I'm not at all the public figure that people think I am. You know, I haven't been in a fight in, it must be, 15 years. I stopped boxing 8 years ago. I'm a man of 68.
Has your approach to writing and rewriting changed at all over the years?
Talking about the process. Yeah. Well, I now look upon myself as having somewhat less talent than I had when I in the middle years, but I have much more skill and savvy, and I'm a much better editor of my own work. I'm sure that any number of reviewers would disagree, but in any event, that's the way I feel. And so I feel if I can get something written that's halfway decent, by the time I get done editing it, it'll be pretty good. Whereas in the old days, I used to write with more smoke and less savvy.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Well, thank you. It went very quickly.
Norman Mailer's latest novel is Harlot's Ghost. William Burroughs' 1959 novel, Naked Lunch, has long been considered one of the masterpieces of the Beat Generation, but its bizarre flights of drug fantasy have made it seem impossible to film. Now David Cronenberg, the Canadian director who made Scanners, The Fly, and Dead Ringers, has adapted it. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a report on the meeting of two unusual minds.
It's more like a triumphal wedding of two minds. David Cronenberg has made a movie that's true to his own gooey sensibility, and yet completely faithful to the freeze-dried spirit of Burroughs. Enter the world of this movie, and you quickly find yourself many, many light years from home. And yet, some of the signposts are pretty down to earth. We're in New York in 1953. The air is brown, the wallpaper is peeling. That's Ornette Coleman on the soundtrack, a little before his time. And here's Peter Weller as Bill Lee, which was Burroughs' own favorite pseudonym. Lee is an exterminator, as Burroughs was for a time. And Cronenberg has had the inspiration to use a lot of other details from Burroughs' life as a kind of passageway into the heart of the novel. There is, for instance, Bill's relationship with his wife, Joan, wonderfully played by Judy Davis. In a brilliant stroke, Cronenberg uses the exterminator's bug powder as a metaphor for the wide range of drugs that Bill and Joan and their circle actually experimented with. In this scene, Bill comes home from a wrangle with the narcotics squad to find Joan injecting bug powder into her right breast.
We've been made. We've got to get out of town.
Wait a minute. What's going on?
I got busted for bug powder. I started hallucinating behind the stuff. God knows what I really said to those two flat feet. I'm not even sure how I got out of there.
Did you bring back tomorrow's bug powder? Did you, Bill? Did you?
My God, Joan. You're acting like a full-fledged junkie. And it's bug powder, for Christ's sake!
Well, I do have a little bit of a habit, yes, hon. You ought to at least give me a few marks for originality.
Bill will later accidentally shoot Joan dead in a game of William Tell, just as Burroughs did in real life. And as in real life, that incident will cause him to escape into more drugs, and then exile, and endless bouts of furious, chaotic writing. The real-life Burroughs went to Tangier, and over a period of years, produced Naked Lunch, about life in the weird, druggy universe he called Interzone. In the movie, Interzone becomes the world that Bill enters every time he takes drugs. It's the world where he has his visions, the world from which he writes. And it looks a lot like Tangier, except for the typewriters that keep turning into giant insects, and the monstrous green creatures known as mugwumps, whose semen is the best high of all. In Interzone, writers are agents, typing up reports on their delirium. The typewriters themselves dictate what those reports contain, and if you change the kind of typewriter you use, that's tantamount to changing the drug you use, so you'll write different stuff. If all this seems a trifle esoteric, well, it is. Cronenberg has written and filmed Naked Lunch on dozens of different levels, and the more you know about Burroughs and the Beat writers, the more you'll get and enjoy. Weller's dead voice and paranoid body language come directly from Burroughs himself. They're a brilliant imitation, but if you've never encountered the Burroughs persona, they may leave you cold. The movie is weirdly hermetic and dreamlike, not to mention occasionally pretty icky. But it's also explosively funny. And finally, even touching. You have to forgive the last half hour or so when Cronenberg scurries to resolve the least interesting and most obscure of the plot's machinations. But no matter. What Cronenberg has made here is one of the most intelligent and even gripping studies of the creative process ever committed to film. Naked Lunch is a profusely imagined portrait of the artist as an aging dope fiend. Take it or leave it. It doesn't stint on the squalor, but it doesn't stint on the dark poetry either.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. It's awfully hard to get a Broadway musical produced, so lyricist Joe Keenan writes novels he hopes capture the spirit of the musical comedies of the 30s. Coming up, a song, a reading, and a conversation with Joe Keenan. Also, rock historian Ed Ward begins a series of reports on how the music of each decade has shaped rock and roll. Today, he turns the clock back 4 decades to 1952. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The State Department has sharply criticized a plan by Israeli officials to deport 12 more Palestinians from the occupied territories, a move that prompted Palestinian negotiators to suspend their participation in next week's peace talks in Washington. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
The State Department has long opposed Israel's practice of deporting Palestinians charged with inciting violence, but the latest deportation order comes at a delicate stage of the peace process, and it brought an unusually sharp rebuke from spokesman Richard Boucher.
The United States strongly condemns the Israeli government's decision to deport Palestinians. We have urged Israel at the highest levels to reconsider and to rescind its decision.
Boucher also condemned Palestinian attacks on Israeli citizens. 4 have been killed recently. But he said deportations do not deter violence. They are simply retaliation. The best way to end the violence, he said, is to pursue peace negotiations. And he urged all parties to return to the table next week as planned. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
A Russian-made helicopter carrying 34 refugees from Cuba landed this morning at a small airport near Miami. U.S. officials say that all those on board the chopper have asked for political asylum. A spokesman for the FAA says the aircraft was spotted on radar about 65 miles off the coast of Florida and was then led to the airport by 2 U.S. military jets. The pilot said that he had been planning the flight for 3 months and had to cancel 2 previous efforts, including one scheduled for last week. Texas Governor Ann Richards says that flooding in Texas is the worst in that state's history. So far, 19 Texas counties have been declared federal disaster areas. Deborah Frazier of member station KUHF in Houston reports.
Governor Richards toured flood-stricken areas of southeast Texas by helicopter today. She says she now realizes how devastating floodwaters have been to thousands of families. At least 2,500 homes across the state have been flooded. Up to 700 remain underwater in southeast Texas. The Brazos River is receding slowly today near Houston, but now threatens communities on the coast as floodwaters head downstream toward the Gulf of Mexico. Meanwhile, the Trinity River has crested, but several feet of water is expected to remain in low-lying neighborhoods for about a week. For National Public Radio, I'm Deborah Frazier in Houston.
Factory orders increased by a modest 0.6% in November, mainly because of orders for new airplanes. This increase follows a 1.9% gain in October and a 2.3% drop in September. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up 29 points to close at 3,201. This is NPR News. In the former Soviet Republic of Georgia, gunmen opened fire on pro-government demonstrators, killing at least 2 people and wounding 25 others. About 3,000 people took part in the rally that occurred one day after opposition leaders said that they had formed a military council and banned rallies in the capital. More than 70 people have been killed in the 2-week-long power struggle, and several hundred others have been injured. According to Radio Russia, the Georgian president has refused to step down and has called for civil disobedience and a general strike. President Bush predicts that he will be reelected later this year, regardless of whether the nation's economy recovers or not. But he adds that he expects the presidential campaign to be a dog-eat-dog fight. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Mr. Bush says he expects the economy will be doing better come November, and that one of the key problems now is the lack of public confidence. The president also acknowledged that most Americans don't feel better off than they did 3 years ago when he was elected.
That really isn't the point. The point is we've got to get this economy moving. We've got to get more jobs. We've got to pass programs to the degree stimulative programs will do it that will help people.
Mr. Bush is not expected to announce his candidacy for re-election until after his State of the Union address and the presentation of his next budget. The president's remarks come in an interview with David Frost recorded before Christmas. It will be aired tonight on public broadcasting stations across the nation. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
In Yugoslavia, another ceasefire has gone into effect, and observers are waiting to see if this latest attempt to end the fighting will work. If peace does take hold, then UN observers will be sent to the nation. 14 earlier truces to end the civil war in Croatia have either been ignored or quickly broke down. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The titles of Joe Keenan's novels, Putting on the Ritz and Blue Heaven, offer a clue to his passion, songwriting. Keenan is a lyricist. Although he hasn't yet made it to Broadway, he did win the 1990 Richard Rodgers Development Award. He's now working on a musical called The Times that he hopes will eventually open on Broadway. The main character in his new novel, Putting on the Ritz, is also a lyricist. The novel is a farce about a young lyricist, his musical collaborator, and their journalist friend. The journalist is writing an exposé about a wealthy New York developer and media mogul. The journalist enlists his songwriter friends to spy on the mogul by writing a cabaret act for his wife, a would-be chanteuse looking for material for her debut at the Rainbow Room. This is the opening of the novel, when the lyricist is still reeling from his recent musical flop.
I've noticed over the years that truly bad ideas like flus trains named for Asian capitals insidiously time their visits to occur during those periods when our defenses, reeling from some previous blow, are at their most tattered and flimsy. I see it all the time. Some friend or acquaintance who'd always seemed the very epitome of reason will be jilted by his lover or passed over for a promotion, and the next time I see him, he's talking about the marvelous career advice he's getting from his astrologer and would I like to buy some nutritional supplements. There are, of course, any number of crises capable of inducing this poignant tendency to grasp at straws. I can, however, say with some authority that few ordeals leave one half so limp and suggestible as the ordeal I had suffered a mere 2 weeks before my story begins. I refer to the spectacular and highly public demise of a musical play to which one has devoted the last 3 years of one's life. The show, a cheeky satire of network television, was called Here for the Season. The book and lyrics were by me, and the music was by my longtime friend and collaborator, Claire Simmons. Its failure, like that of most flops, was the end result of a whole series of dire miscalculations. If pressed, though, to name the one decision that really drove a stake through the thing's heart, it would be my agreement to accept as co-librettist our renowned director's 24-year-old boyfriend. Claire, whose radar at such times is more functional than my own, argued against it, but I felt that the script needed only minor changes, and the youngster, who seemed amiable enough, was not seeking a dominant role so much as a ride on our coattails. This proved incorrect. We soon learned that our co-author, far from being amiable, was a violently opinionated young man who, when contradicted, displayed a temper that called to mind Caligula with a toothache. To make matters worse, the director's only response to his paramour's screaming fits was to scream louder. If you want an idea of what our average rehearsal was like, rent a martial arts film and watch the last 20 minutes. Chaos reigned. Actors quit, songs were cut, scenes came and went with dizzying speed, and the whole gossamer fabric of the show unraveled like a congressman's alibi.
That's a great opening. I'm wondering if you ever had a musical flop.
Not yet, but I'm young.
Well, have you had anything open yet?
I had a little off-Broadway review called Close Enough for Jazz, but it was strictly not off-Broadway, actually. It was off-Broadway, and that was a limited run. The only thing I've done since is this show, The Times, which I've been working on for about 3 years now. I took a hiatus from my musical writing career to write Blue Heaven.
That was your first novel.
It was my first novel.
Yeah, I know the question you're supposed to ask songwriters is what comes first,
the music or the lyrics, but, you know, I'm tempted to ask you which came first, the novels or the songs.
Well, I was writing, I've been writing songs for a long time. Since I was in high school and college, I had little musicals that I wrote and were produced at my high school and then in college. When I got to New York, I worked on a play called Vinaigrette, which had an equity workshop, which ran about 8 weeks, but was not really produced after that. And then I went into NYU when I was only 24, and that kept me busy until I was 26. And when I got out of that, I began the novel. So my songwriting career keeps getting pushed off in favor of other things which are easier to get off the ground and, in the main, more lucrative.
Why is writing a book easier to get off the ground than songwriting?
Well, because it's non-collaborative. To be honest, I find it much simpler. I find songwriting incredibly difficult. It's not incredibly difficult, but it's much more time-consuming. A song that takes only 3 or 4 minutes to sing can consume a month of your time, because lyric writing is just a time-consuming craft.
Stephen Sondheim says that he loves writing songs because they're like puzzles, and he loves puzzles. But do you hate that aspect of it, where everything has to fit so perfectly?
No, you can love it or hate it. It's just the way that it works.
Yeah.
I find it frustrating, of course, because Sondheim is a very frustrating man for all lyricists to deal with, because he's demonstrated just how high the art can be taken, and those who appreciate that set a new level of craftsmanship for themselves, with the result that everything takes a great deal longer to do. But I believe they take him a damn long time as well. He's always talking about how many drafts things go through,
mm-hmm.
and what an arduous and time-consuming practice it is. You just have to be very, very patient. Whereas I find prose flows very easily. I mean, it's not simplicity itself, but if I sit down to write prose, I can usually write 3 or 4 pages a day. And in the same month it would take me to write one technically complicated lyric, I can write 50 pages.
So what got you to sit down and write your first novel?
What happened was I had long wanted to try something in this vein, because I was a big fan of Woodhouse and wondered why, not just Woodhouse, but E.F. Benson, another light comic novelist, and wondered why nobody seemed to be doing it anymore. And I found myself between semesters at NYU living at home with my parents, because I'd had to leave one apartment and I was going to move in with my lover, but had to wait 4 months until his sister had moved out and gone to Japan. And I began writing my lover 7 or 8 page letters every day. And after a couple of weeks of that, I said, well, if I can write 7 or 8 pages of prose every day, maybe I'll try a short story, because I had never attempted fiction. And the story willy-nilly bloomed into blue heaven.
My guest is Joe Keenan. His new novel is called Putting on the Ritz. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is novelist and lyricist Joe Keenan. The musical that you've been working on, The Times, has a song in it about an imaginary book review. We actually have a tape of this song, and I'd like for you to explain the context of it, and this will help us tie together your two careers of literature and songwriting.
Well, the musical is called The Times, and it's actually a good deal more grim in its intent than any of my comic fiction. It's about life among the 98% of the people who come to New York full of artistic dreams and aspirations and find that they do not succeed, and that they're staring at early middle age and nothing has happened to them, and how you cope with that, particularly in the context of a society which is always dividing the winners from the losers and holding out the carrot for you. And at any rate, the main character is a frustrated novelist who's been working on a very big, overly ambitious book for about 6 or 7 years. And this is his fantasy review. In the show, it's clear that he imagines that John Updike is singing this in a front-page review in the Sunday Times book review section.
Who will we hear singing with?
It's a very talented man named Nick Wyman, who is in the original cast of Phantom of the Opera. And the other singer that you'll hear is a man named Stuart Zagnit.
Who wrote the music? You wrote the lyrics.
The music was written by my very talented collaborator, Mr. Brad Ross.
Once, maybe twice, in every generation, there appears on the scene a genius in his prime, armed with a book That's an eloquent summation of his people and his nation and his culture and his time. And I have read such a book, profound but also clever and composed in a style beguiling and sublime. There have been epics before, but absolutely never as enthralling an endeavor as...
What am I calling it this week?
Epics before, but absolutely never as enthralling an endeavor as... Whatever, here is a tale of madness and salvation by a man who's begun a wonderful career. Theodore Henry Harrison's a visionary voice, welcoming comparisons to Twain and James and Joyce. And what a book he's produced! Why, Proust would have to cheer. Oh, the great American novelist is here.
Have you been reading a lot of book reviews to figure out what cliches you wanted to get into the song?
Well, at the time I wrote that song, which is about 2 years ago, I certainly spent a lot of time reading book reviews, looking for the catchphrases that go into overly florid rave reviews.
Let's get back to your new novel. The main character in this novel is a lyricist who's just had a failed show, and he gets this offer to write a club act for a very, very, very wealthy woman. She's the wife of a very, very, very wealthy developer.
She's very wealthy. In fact, it's said of her that she ovulates Fabergé eggs.
Yes. you play with a lot of the cliches of the club acts, the way, you know, the autobiographical patter works into the anthem-like songs. So what were some of the cliches that you wanted to make sure to get in?
The cliches of cabaret. Well, mm-hmm. Just the extravagant melodrama that some singers bring to a lot of their songs. The penchant for autobiographical excess. Too many people, it seems, model their cabaret acts around their personal experience and assume incorrectly that there is no facet of their life which is of not inordinate fascination to the audience at large. And they look for very tenuous autobiographical links to the songs that they want to sing. More than anything, it's just extravagantly bad over-emotional singing. It was one of the cliches that I wanted to have some fun with.
You wrote an excerpt of a song for your book, a song called Hard to Be Me. And this is a song that the lyricist in the book, the main character, comes up with for this wealthy woman who's putting together a club act. Can you recite a little bit of the song and describe what you were getting at, what kind of song you were getting at with this?
Well, the song was something that they had not written for the woman. They'd already written it before they went in, and they decided very daringly to audition with the piece. It's the song is described as the lament of a filthy rich socialite who's telling her maid how fortunate the servant is not to lead a life so glamorous and exhausting as her own. And what it's really getting at is the propensity of the rich to moan and kvetch about their lives as if they were not lives, chock full of privilege. Some of the lines include, although you may think it's all trinkets and minkets, hard to be me. Another section is, the staff that needs training, the mad entertaining night after night, and even complaining is terribly draining if you're doing it right.
You describe the book as a musical comedy kind of reality. Do you think of that as what you're doing, taking the musical comedy sensibility and putting it into a novel form?
I think that would be a fair approximation of the style and effect of the books, yes. But musical comedy not in the contemporary sense, but musical comedy in the 30s and 40s sense.
Kind of Noel Coward,
where things were
Cole Porter.
Lighter and larkier.
Yeah, yeah. Do you ever feel like you're not in the right era? I mean, do you ever wish that you were living in an era when there was more musical comedy?
Well, no, to the extent that I seem to be one of very few people doing this. I don't think I'm in the wrong era at all. There are times when I think it might have been nicer living back then, but then I think of other aspects of life in previous decades. For instance, the dreadful institutionalized homophobia where gay people, where a gay writer could not write frankly about his character's sexuality at all. And I think that, those decades would not have been so hospitable as they may seem from this distance.
Joe Keenan's new novel is called Puttin' on the Ritz.
This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Lots of money news on today's program. We'll be hearing about talk in Washington of revisiting the most recent federal budget resolution to possibly spring some more money out of the defense budget into domestic concerns. Also news of major Medicare reforms that change the way in which doctors may bill, evening out the fees that specialists and general practitioners can claim, a special report by Patricia Naimond. And news from Russia and some of the other former republics of the Soviet Union about how economic reform, specifically the lifting of price controls, is going after a couple of days there.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The new year invites a review of past years. In this first week of 1992, we're kicking off a four-part series by our rock and roll historian, Ed Ward. He's decided to go back 10, 20, 30, and 40 years to see what was happening back then musically. For starters, the sounds of 1952.
Although it's really pointless to speculate exactly when rock and roll was born as such, there's really no question that in 1952 it was already kicking at the slats of its cradle. By 1952, the post-war recovery of the entertainment business was well underway, and a bunch of independent labels were rushing into the black and country markets and cleaning up. The pop charts may have had the same old crooners and orchestras on them, but around the edges things were getting weird and modern. Country music had been thrust into a new era by the uncompromising songwriting of Hank Williams, who would die on the very last day of the year, and by the enduring popularity of jazz-tinged Western swing. The two tendencies combined to make one of the year's top country hits.
I didn't know God made honky-tonk angels. I might have known you'd never make a wife. You gave up the only one that ever loved you and went back to the wild side of life.
Along with Webb Pierce's 1952 hit Backstreet Affair, Hank Thompson's Wild Side of Life dealt with the urban realities many country folk were contending with, a life where mother, Bible, and farming had been supplanted with dirt, drink, and double dealing. The golden era of country music was only beginning in 1952, but the rhythm and blues scene was going berserk. Chicago, Memphis, New Orleans, and Los Angeles were throwing out more good talent than anybody could keep track of. Typical of the quality of 52's R&B scene was the number one R&B record of the year. Price's Lottie Miss Claudie not only had the best band New Orleans was capable of assembling, it also had a piano introduction by nobody less than Fats Domino, who himself had a big hit with Going Home. Memphis was going insane.
Told me that you would leave me here in tears. But now you're gone and I seem like you. I sing my song.
Forget the out-of-tune piano. Johnny Ace was the first teen idol for young black girls, and My Song launched a career that would only last 2 years until his mysterious death, allegedly playing Russian roulette. Ace was part of the Beale Street scene in Memphis, and his running buddies included Bobby Blue Bland and B.B. King, the latter of whom hit in 52 with his first record, 3 O'Clock Blues. Memphis was so hot in 1952 that finally, the man who owned the studio where most of the hits were recorded, Sam Phillips, decided to stop supplying labels in L.A. and Chicago with hits and put them out himself. In November, he released Blues in My Condition by Jackie Boy and Little Walter on the Sun Records label. It was a horrible record, and it died instantly, but Sun would become important real soon. Also around the end of the year, a couple of Jewish teenagers in Los Angeles nervously turned a song over to Willie Mae Thornton, a vocalist who was working with bandleader Johnny Otis. Would this be their big hit?
You ain't nothing but a hound dog. Been snooping around the door. You ain't nothing but a hound dog. Been snooping around the door. You can wag your tail, but I ain't gonna feed you no more.
Of course, it was. And within a couple of years, Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller and Sam Phillips and a kid who was still in high school named Elvis Presley would all change history. But in 1952, only the foundations of rock and roll were being laid. Future stars were making their first records, the 45 RPM single with the big hole was just catching on, and if you lived in Philadelphia and had a television, you could come home from school and watch a brand new program called American Bandstand with its host, middle-aged Bob Horn. Rock and roll was on its way, and although nobody could have guessed it in 1952, it was already too late to stop it.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll, and he writes for the Austin Chronicle. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Vlblaitis and Richard Parker. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester. It's performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Jules Shear Unplugged. Singer-songwriter Jules Shear brings his guitar to our studios and plays some new songs. Also, we talk with Ernest Dickerson. After working as the cinematographer on all of director Spike Lee's movies, Dickerson has just directed his first feature film. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.